Welcome to the Free Dev Cafe, episode 116 with Gary McGrath. My name is Donnie. I'm the host of the Free Dev Cafe. The Free Dev Cafe is the long-form interview podcast that explores the backstories, the training, the challenges, the combined wisdom and personal philosophies of the world's free divers. The website is freedivecafe.com. Search Free Dev Cafe on Facebook and like it. I'm on Instagram as Freedive and Thrive. The podcast is available on all good podcast players for your mobile devices. The Free Dive Cafe is an ongoing project now in its fourth year, and I have always been supported in this endeavor by the lovely donations of patrons. If you like the show, if you want to ask your questions of the guests, get early access to episodes and extended episodes, then head over to patreon.com/freedivecafe and look at your options for joining the Free Dive Cafe family. It is much appreciated. And welcome to new patrons, Tom, Maurizio, Chahao, I think here in Taiwan, Claire Paris. Thanks, Claire. Claire was the last guest on the show. And Michael. Sorry if I missed anyone. Okay, so on today's show, we are welcoming back Gary McGrath for his second appearance. Gary's episode of 109 was very popular, but I did receive some complaints that we rambled on too much about boring things like, you know, his life and stuff, and didn't talk about serious freedivery stuff like training and all that. And that's what these Training Talk dedicated episodes are for. So for everyone that wants to take a deep dive into Gary's approach to training, and he's now one of the deepest men in the world, this episode is for you. This is a Training Talk episode. I often do these with previous guests and release the episodes early on Patreon. I think there's something like 12 Training Talks already up there on Patreon. So make sure to join Patreon if you want them when they are fresh out of the podcast oven. What was interesting about this episode was discussing with Gary his experience having COVID and how it's affected his freediving and the decisions that he's making with regard to that and his freediving future. Very interesting. I should also add that Gary now has his own freediving podcast, and he is producing that with another popular Freedive Cafe guest and coach, Mr. Harry Chamas of Freedive Passion. That is the In-Depth podcast, and I believe it is also available on all good podcast platforms, and I'll leave a link to it in the show notes for the episode, which will be at freedivecafe.com/GaryTrainingTalk. Before we get to Gary, just a quick reminder that my new yoga education service is now available. The website is thrivespaceyoga.com and the Instagram is thrivespaceyoga. And you can sign up for online classes there. The first class is free. Just go to thrivespaceyoga and follow the instructions. All right, now answering all your most requested freediving training questions, Mr. Gary McGrath. Let's dive. So, yeah, before we get into the Training Talk questions, Gary, you know, you told me that you had COVID. Tell us about that and what it's like having COVID as a freediver.
Yeah, COVID's not that great. I wouldn't really recommend it. And it seems like I had a bit of a bad strain of it. A few people I've spoken to since who've had it, they were just sort of in bed for a couple of days and then sort of, you know, slowly getting up and moving around. I was flattened out. I was battered for 5-6 days with the worst fever I've ever had in my life. I mean, it was really hot in Sharm El Sheikh and I was just, my teeth were chattering. I was shivering, but my temperature was like 41, 42, I think it was. So yeah, that was weird. 5 days of that. And then the worst thing about it was the length of time it took me to get back on my feet. You know, I'm in pretty good shape, and I've had bad flu and stuff, and 3-4 days you're on your back, but then when it's over, it's over. COVID just kept going on. It was 3 weeks until I felt like I wanted to be in the outside world, and until I felt I could think straight. That was the kind of most concerning thing, is how it affected my brain. I couldn't do simple things like sums and writing on my phone or anything like that, small details. It was things like that were slow, and that was worrying.
Yeah. So in total, how long do you think you were kind of like, you know, with the fever for a few days and then the recovery? Like, do you feel like you're back to normal now?
I feel absolutely back to normal. I'd say within 4 weeks, I felt like totally back to normal. But also, you know, we're free divers. So in a free diving sense, I'm not 100% sure if I'm back to normal, you know, dealing with pressures on the lungs and stuff. So I waited 6 or 7 weeks, and then I tested it, getting back in the water a little bit, getting down to residual, felt good. And then I tried to do a slightly deeper session, and it just felt a lot more rustier than it should have. I felt like I'd taken 6 months or a year off diving completely, whereas in reality I'd only been out of the water for about 6 weeks. And that was a bit concerning. I didn't squeeze or anything, but it definitely didn't feel normal. So I've actually made the decision to kind of hold off competitions for the rest of the year, probably. Hold off any sort of extreme depth training. I think I'm just playing the long game with that. I'm looking forward 1 year down the line, 2 years down the line. I want to make sure I'm completely recovered.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I mean, taking the rest of the year off is no big thing, since there's still, you know, more than half of it to go. What about your lungs, though? Did you have like any sort of like bronchial issues, pneumonia, anything like that, or was it just the fever?
No, there was no secondary sort of illnesses. I didn't catch anything from being in a sort of sick state. I had CT scan and X-ray while it was at its worst, and they came up pretty clear. The doctors were really happy with them. I saw someone else's who seemed to have a slightly less severe version of COVID than I had, and their chest X-ray was just cloudy. It was just white clouds all over. But I didn't have any of that. Mine was really clear, which I was really surprised by, because when I had the CT scan, I was coughing blood. I had about a week, 5 days of coughing blood.
You know, okay, so you actually were coughing blood.
Yeah. I had the fever, and then after the fever sort of died down, it sort of settled in the chest area. I wasn't like rattly or anything. It wasn't like I had a need, you know, when you have a big like whooping cough or something, you have phlegm in there, really need to get out. It wasn't anything like that, but I couldn't breathe over halfway. Anything above halfway was hurting, actually, my lungs. So my breathing was super shallow. And then, you know, every now and again, I'd feel something in the top of my airways, and I'd want to cough, and then I'd get up very, sorry if anyone's eating their dinner, I'd get up very browny, almost ready, phlegm, sorry again for anyone eating, but
lay it on.
The texture was really weird. You know when neoprene glue goes bad in the tube and you squeeze it out and it doesn't fit to anything anymore? It was like that.
Okay, right. So, I mean, that is pretty serious and pretty scary as well. And I can understand a lot more why, you know, when you experience those kind of symptoms with your lungs as a freediver, that it must hurt, but it seems like a very sensible idea to take a very long period off and really make sure that you're back to 100% before you do any deep dives.
And it really wasn't a hard decision to make, to be honest. I'm totally happy with the decision. In the first few days, I was like, oh, well, what am I going to do now? And then I realized, yeah, you know, I do have to work for a living and I can focus on plenty of other things. So it's okay. I'll be back. Hopefully the record's not going to go anywhere, because the dive, when I realized I had COVID, was the last comp dive I did, which would have been the British national record. It would have been 112. But the dive was an absolute disaster. And that evening I started to feel a bit unwell. And the next day, boom, it came. COVID came.
Right. We'll let you off then this time. Okay, let's fire into these training talk questions then. This is the new format for the training talk questions. There's quite a lot here, so it's up to you how much time you want to concentrate on each question, or if you want to fire through them quite quickly. Usually when we did these interviews before, they were, you know, generally shorter than the regular interviews, but you're welcome to take as much time as you want explaining these points for us. Yeah. Okay. So, what is your favorite freediving discipline and why?
Well, I've just been a constant weight diver for years. I think quite early on, I got given a cheap monofin, and that kind of got me hooked. So I've stuck with it. Really, I love the monofin. I love the speed of it. I love the actual movement of it. So that's kind of what I've fallen into focusing most of my energy on. I think there's something to be said with directing most of your attention to one thing. I would like the opportunity now, perhaps, as I'm shallower in the other disciplines, perhaps this summer I can get back to working on those a bit and become a bit more of an all-rounder. But yeah, for me, it's definitely the monofin.
And when you say you got the monofin quite early on, like at what depth were you diving with bifins when you started to work with the monofin?
Really quite shallow in the grand scheme of things, probably 20-30 meters. You know, probably in the first year or two of being like a London-based pool diver, someone gave me an old pool fin that fitted me, and then I just focused on that. I did lots of free immersion in the beginning as well, when I was going out on dive trips, but I always had the monofin there. I always enjoyed the monofin, but you need to develop the EQ tools, the EQ skills with the monofin. You've got to be good enough to keep up with the speed of it sometimes in the first 30 meters. So yeah, I guess in the beginning, constant weight and free immersion went hand in hand, but I've definitely gone more for monofin now.
And I guess spending all that time in the pool with the monofin gave you like a solid basis in terms of technique, because it must be much harder to get the technique down if you only have that opportunity to do it when you're diving deep, and you also have to deal with things like equalization and thermoclines or whatever as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, pool is the key to a lot of things. It's our gym, really, for free divers. I couldn't imagine just not spending any time in a pool with a monofin and then immediately just going to try depth. I mean, it's going to be a bit of a car crash, I think. But yeah, pool is definitely where you consolidate all the skills and learn the technique. Looking back, I'm kind of glad I had that base of pool training. You know, I was stuck in London just finding out if I liked free diving, you know, training every week. And it's that set me up with decent technique and made the transition into depth swimming vertically much more easier.
Right. So do you have a coach and who do you train with? And that also reminds me, that was the other thing, actually. I saw that you were posting about that you did the equalization training with Federico Mana.
Yeah.
And, you know, so tell us about, you know, who your coach and your training partners are, but also tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
So as for coach, you know, when I first started, I was really lucky to sort of find myself training with all the guys on the British team, really, guys and girls, you know. So I always had, like, I was, because the community is so small in the UK, I had really experienced people to bounce ideas off and to eavesdrop and copy, basically. Right. But other than that, I've not really used a coach. I've used personal trainers, but not freediving personal trainers, just for general fitness. And I definitely recommend personal trainers. But coach-wise, no, I've kind of sort of made progressions on my own. But then a lot of my friends are coaches and stuff. So it's not like I've hired someone for a year and said, right, I'm yours, write me a full program, but I've definitely always had good, knowledgeable people to bounce ideas off. So that's been quite a useful thing in the community.
Yeah, it's quite a nice little community that you have going on there in the UK. And you often notice that when people don't have access to the water, they're not in locations like Dahab or Bohol or whatever, that the pool training communities get very strong and you know, a lot of good stuff happens there. And you know, so this equalization training that you did with Federico, and you're offering that training now, you know, what difference has it made for you to do that training?
Yeah, it's made a lot, both with my own diving and my teaching as well. So the main, like, what it's taught me is a bit more method to equalizing. I, you know, my equalizing is fairly solid, but in the past I had all the same problems that anyone else has ever had, you know, losing air through your glottis, swallowing, air trapped in the mouth, soft palate locks, things like this, all the same problems. And I kind of wish I would have met Federico 10 years ago, because it could have saved me quite a lot of work. It's like, it was a full-on course. It was 12 weeks weekly. It was all taught online. It was weekly webinars of sort of 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours, and then sort of assessment as you go along, and then a final exam. So 12 weeks of it, you know, I've been doing this since about February, it feels like, March maybe, yeah. And then, yeah, we finally did the exam last month. Yeah, and the kind of his system, it's more of a written down method, so people aren't having to filter through hundreds of YouTube videos, listening to little snippets of conversation like I was. Well, I wasn't even using YouTube when I was trying to iron out these problems, because there wasn't really much on there. But I was like fishing everywhere for information, and this is like more of a system to it, more of a method, which I think equalization has to be. It's a really straightforward process. Like, it's a pneumatic system. You squeeze one bit to send the air to the other bit. I mean, you can't really get much simpler. But then there's all the little all the little technicalities that go along with it.
Yeah, that sounds good, because especially with such a long program, it's the consistency that you develop is often what is lacking in any kind of discipline that somebody tries to achieve, whether it's meditation or yoga or, you know, kettlebell training or whatever it is. But so, yeah, that's something I might look back into then, Federico's trainings. And is that open to anyone who wants to? I mean, you're also doing it as well, right? So do you do the same thing, like the 3 month thing, or do you have like an abbreviated course?
Well, this was the instructor course that I took. So now I'm a share equalization instructor. Share is the name of his equalization academy.
It's crappy name.
I'll let you tell him that. Right. And built into this platform is they have various courses. One's called Deep, which is focusing more on mouthfeel, more and slightly advanced. There's another one called Evo. I hope I'm naming these right. But they're geared towards different levels, you know, beginner, intermediate and advanced. And each one, they're not all 12 weeks long. Some of them are only 4 or 5 weeks, but you've got a choice. With him, you can either buy through the website and just get access to the material, which is step-by-step guides for each of the exercises. And then you get videos. You also get the chance to have a bit of a WhatsApp checkup as you're going along. Or you can go full on, pay a little bit more, and you get like one-on-one time with an instructor. So that's kind of what I'm going for, where I will open up the next unit for you. We'd meet up once a week online, teach you the new skill, and you'd spend a week or maybe two learning the skill, sending me videos back and forth. I'll give you tips, and then we meet up the next week and progress like that.
All right, cool, sounds good. I'll put that in the back of my mind for, you know, if this lockdown shit continues to progress much longer, because it's going to be good to have something to do like that. Right, so do you periodize your training through the year?
Yes and no. I'm not an overly technical diver the way I train. I don't have precise things I need to do on certain days or certain weeks, but I do have a general periodization of basically trying to focus on building and maintaining muscle in the lead up to a depth season. I try these days, I'm actually trying to put on quite a bit more muscle, because I noticed over this period, over the winter, I lost quite a lot of muscle mass, and I was just starting to find the limits of my sort of oxygen tolerances. Had a small, my first sort of depth LMC at 111 in about 10 years. I had a little wobble, and I thought, okay, now perhaps I need to focus on putting a bit more muscle on and doing a bit more things like cycling and running, try and get those muscles used to working. But yeah, other than that, I like my peaking period to be quite long. Mentally is my biggest sort of concern. Mental fatigue. Physically, I can keep going, but it's the mental fatigue. So I want my proper target dive sessions to be about 2 weeks. After that, I start to lose mental focus a bit, and I need to take at least a week break.
Okay, so what kind of dry training do you do? You mentioned that you're trying to put some muscle on there, which I guess you're doing with, you know, resistance training. But in terms of, yeah, do you have any specific apnea training that you do dry?
Actually, not really. I don't do a lot, but that's also because I'm fortunate to be living somewhere where I've got depth and I've got pools and stuff here. If I was back in London having less access to depth, I would be doing some kind of simple breath holding. And a lot of that would be almost more of a mental thing, just to keep your mind checked into the activity that we're aiming towards. I don't go into massive programs of huge tables or anything like that. In the past, I have, when I've been based in London, focusing on static or something like that over the winters, then obviously that becomes a bit of a different story. But for depth, no, I just try and stay generally fit. The main emphasis in any dry training I do, I do spend a lot of time doing EQ drills, because the benefits of doing dry EQ drills are just huge. You know, why fly out somewhere where you've got depth on your limited time and spend the first week trying to remind yourself how to EQ? It all becomes dry. You know, you can cure most problems dry in the water, just for testing, you know.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's something that I definitely need to learn much more about. All right, so you've been a big pool guy in the past. Describe your favorite pool training sessions.
I like getting the meters in. I like big long technique sessions, really. So I mean, I was talking to another friend, Ruth. She comes from a swimming background, and I swam a bit through my teens, and you know, a standard swimmer's warm up is, you know, do 800 meters front crawl. And you say 800 meters as a warm up to most free divers who don't really enjoy the pool, and they're going to crap themselves, you know. But I think a pool session, yeah, I like to do 2K minimum, 2.5K is a good session. Various, you know, overs and unders, technique on different sides of the body. A bit of resistance training in there. Swim parachutes are great. But I like long swim sessions of just getting the laps in, you know. I enjoy that, the meditative aspect of it as well. And I think it's really important to have a pool base.
How do you structure depth training sessions, and how does it change through the year or the season? And I'm also just going to bring in the second question, the next question, and that is, like, do you warm up? You know, like, how do you warm up? What is your warm up protocol, if you have one?
Yeah, so like for the first question, depth training sessions, you know, it depends how long I've been out of the water. You know, if I'm coming from a winter in Europe, then I'm going to spend a long time doing things like exhale diving and just doing shallow repeats down to just residual or just below residual, 30, 35, something like that. When I arrived here in November, although I had a summer of teaching and, you know, sort of recreationally being in the water, I still spent, for the first, I think, 12, 15 days, I didn't go below 12 meters, really. I was just doing residual volume exhale dives. I was just focusing on exhale dives, and then I slowly increased. It was about almost a month before I was really going below 50, 60 maybe. But I was lucky, I had time, you know. I had the luxury of time, so I didn't have to rush too much. And what was the second part?
The second part was if you do warm-ups, you know, like no warm-up diving is becoming, you know, a lot more popular in certain circles. Do you still do a warm-up or several warm-ups before you do a deep dive? How does that work?
Yeah, I do. I played about with it a bit this winter because, you know, it did get a bit cold. And I was diving with Alice Modulo a lot, and she's wearing a 1.5 mil suit, whereas most people are in 5 mils. And she's coming out, she's doing no warm-up, doing a deep dive, and then getting out. She's in the water for 10, 12 minutes. I had done no warm-ups before, but you have to be really dive fit and you have to have a good mental process. I think you've got to be very mentally prepared. So normally I'm doing one warm-up, which is just literally a hang, 2 minute hang at 18, just to welcome myself into the water, really. But the no warm up dives I did a 92 in the Blue Hole, and it felt fantastic. It felt really good. I was amazed at how fresh I felt afterwards. So there's definitely a lot of benefits to it, but you've got to have your dive system. What I always talk about with students I'm coaching is have a pattern to the dive that is completely repeatable, that you don't change, you know. And I've had the same pattern, like same number of kicks, same amount of time to breathe up, taking the free fall exactly the same, the mouth feel, sorry, exactly the same spot. The turn is identical. If you've got that ingrained into you, then, you know, no warm-up dives, it gets easier.
Yeah, so a lot of potential in no warm-up dives, but it's just about, you know, finding that, you know, getting to that point where your mental game is good enough that you kind of override the need to have warm-up dives, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. If you've got that pattern that doesn't change, that you can rely on, whether the wind's blowing a gale or whether it's flat calm, then that's going to really help you.
Okay, so do you pack? And if you do, how many times do you pack?
I do pack. Pack about 20 times. I could probably go maximum up to 30 or something, but I don't need it. I sort of came here in November packing around 15 times, and then I've increased that a little bit as I stuck more depth on, I wanted to be able to take the mouthful slightly deeper. And so far, 20 packs is giving me plenty of air left at 112, 113, you know. So I pack as I need it. But yeah, I do. I think it's useful. But then you have to, you know, there's other concerns with packing. You have to be aware of it on the way up. You know, I think it's a very wise move to exhale slightly as you're coming into the last 5 meters of the ascent, for, you know, over expansion sort of concerns and stuff.
Right, that's good that you bring that up, because that question that I have, which is do you exhale before surfacing or remove the nose clip before surfacing, I'll move that one up to follow from the packing question. Because, yeah, that is a concern, that if you've had some kind of fluid move into the airspace in the lungs, that there could be a risk of overexpansion. And what about the nose clip? Do you take that off before you surface?
No, I don't see any need to. I know some people that I've dived with, you know, they're pulling the nose clip off and then it's almost like an explosion of air coming out of their nose. It's really like you can hear it with some people. And that's just because their soft palate locks up. There's probably a tension there, and some people feel that their nose, literally, they have to take it off, mm-hmm. because it's going to expand, and that's not what you want. That comes down to you need to work on soft palate exercises to be able to hold the soft palate open and let that air flow back out. That shouldn't be happening, as far as I'm concerned. So no, I don't feel any need to take my nose clip off.
Today's sponsor of the show is the inimitable 2B Free Equipment. This top-of-the-line freediving equipment company is the result of massive experience and inspiration from the imagination of world champion Ukrainian freediver Alexander Bubenchikov, comes very high quality freediving gear and accessories. I'm a huge fan of the buoys from To Be Free. I've been singing their praises for years and have several of them here at my school. But the other gear is also top-notch too. Lanyards, pulley systems, line stoppers, and even fins. Basically, just go to the website and check out this very extensive range of gear. Best thing is, as a Freedive Cafe listener, you get an awesome 10% discount on anything you order there. To do that, visit the website, choose your products, and use the discount code FreediveCafe at the checkout, and there you have it. The website is tobefreeequipment.com. Check it out and get the very best for your freediving setup. All right, let's get back to Gary. That's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I've had, you know, many, many people in the last couple of years who have wanted to sort of try the nose clip, and a majority of them have that thing where they get up to, you know, like the last few meters, you know, the last like 8-7 meters or something, and they start to feel this pressure in their nose. And I always wondered what that was. So it's interesting that you mentioned that.
Yeah, and it can be cured just by bringing awareness to the soft palate, which is a tricky thing. If you're not born with awareness naturally, you know, the soft palate exercises that I've just been going through on Freddie's course, they were the most challenging part, because I'm not a natural hands freer or anything like that. So yeah, it is a skill that needs to be practiced. Yeah.
Oh, there's a good question then. Can you hands free?
No, I'm slowly learning. I've got some exercises to work on. I do need to dedicate more time. But one of the courses Freddie's got, I haven't been through how to teach that yet. But him and his other instructors, they do teach it, is how to learn hands free. You know, and he's got a pretty good system where he's taught quite a lot of people to hands free. Also, Roberto Butera, who's based here, Italian diver, he teaches people hands-free. He's got a really good system, and he's got quite a good success rate, actually. He does like one-day courses, and he's you know, in one day, he can sort of give you certainly the basis of it. So it's a bit of a, it's not so much of a magical alchemy kind of unreachable goal as I thought it was. It's just waking up little bits of your head that you've never had to control before. So it's achievable, definitely.
Okay, good. And it's good that we brought that up, because I definitely I was supposed to put in the question into this training talk format about dry EQ training. And you've already covered that. Obviously, we've just covered that in detail, that you think that it's extremely important. So that's good that you reminded me, and I'll put that in for the next interview. Okay, at what depth do you begin your free fall? And I'll also just add on to that, why do you do, I don't know if it's related or not, but why do you do your hang at 18 meters? I don't know if they're now completely unrelated questions, but I like to double my questions up.
Yeah, because by the time I got through the first one, I've forgotten what the second one is.
So I've forgotten what both the questions are now. Let's start with, why do you do your hang and your warm up at 18 meters?
Why not? Basically, I think because I feel that 20 is too deep, and I feel that 16 is too shallow. You know, 18 is deep enough, so you're just a little bit below your neutral point, so you're not fighting floating up all the time. I don't want to go too deep. Back years ago, I did used to do a couple of FRC warm-ups, but there's a lot of stuff I read, some anecdotal stuff, that there might possibly be a link between deep FRCs as warm-ups and lung injury, basically, because you are putting your lungs under quite a bit of stress. So I stopped doing those years ago, and to be honest, it didn't make a difference. I was still feeling fine. But, you know, I guess it takes away any possible, if there's a possibility of it exacerbating the depth, giving you an injury, then I guess it's good to stay away from it.
So what depth do you begin your free fall?
Alarm's at 27. So I've got 10 kicks down with the mono. Then my arms come, I do my arm stroke, arms are down by my side. Then I'm sort of doing a last sort of top up of my mouth feel, another couple of kicks, and then I normally hear my alarm around then. Last little top up of mouth feel, and then a few more kicks as long as I feel like I'm going fast enough. Then, yeah, so I'm probably finishing my last kicks, kick 13, kick 14 at around 28, 30 or something like that. Yeah, but what I've started to do recently is actually kick fairly deep. And the odd, you know, a kick every 6-7 meters or something, down to about 50, actually. You know, I noticed that's the beauty of Divi, seeing what other people are doing. And I played about with it. I wanted to knock a few seconds off my dive times because I knew I felt like I was getting close to a hypoxic limit. And the extra kicks on the way down didn't seem to burn more oxygen. They seemed to actually get me down there a bit quicker. So yeah, I started to kick down to 50, maybe a last one just past 50.
And yeah, I mean, as a monofin diver, you probably you have your hands up, your arms over your head the whole way up, right, on the ascent?
Yeah, as soon as I turn, I probably do 4 or 5 kicks with my hands by my side, and then the arms will gently come up, and then I'll get into my streamline position, and then the work starts.
Yeah, it's odd. I've seen some people who will have their hands by their sides for the whole ascent and doing some quite deep dives as well. And it seems to be, I don't know, it looks kind of painful actually to do it that way.
Yeah, I know one of my mates here in particular who I trained with all winter. He's just got really inflexible shoulders. It's just the way he's built, and holding those arms up ahead is actually really uncomfortable for him. Hmm. So he's diving in 70, I think he did 80, and he's coming up with his hands by his side because that's what works for him. Arms up just kind of burns him out.
Yeah,
and he's been diving for a long time as well, and he's been really working on his flexibility, but it's not really coming. So arms by your side, yeah. And with bifins as well. I don't. Did you interview Kurt Chambers? I was chatting to Kurt Chambers, he's quite methodical and quite sort of scientific with the way he analyzes his training. And he did a lot of tests with arms by the side, arms up ahead. He's a bifinner, and he said he found pretty much no difference. And he's diving, you know, I think he might have been just over 100 with bifins. So yeah, I trust what he says. That it didn't make a huge amount of difference. So that's quite interesting, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the times, I mean, yeah, you can analyze it sort of scientifically or like as scientifically as you can when you're basing it on your own experience, but it really is like your own experience. It's like if you can't quantify a difference, then really you're going to do what feels good for you, right? If you feel that you're kind of moving better or moving faster or moving more streamlined because you have your hands overhead and you have good shoulder mobility, then by all means do it, you know. And even if we could prove subsequently that there was a 5% reduction in efficiency because you did that, then it would still be worth it, I guess, if it keeps you relaxed and saves oxygen, right?
Yeah, but then it all depends on it does depend on your upper sort of thorax flexibility. You know, there's arms above your head, and then there's proper arms above your head. You know, a lot of people, they lift their shoulders up. They're desperate to try and close any air, any water spaces between their ears and their arms. And that is kind of the wrong approach because it brings a lot of tension there. And if you ask any Russian diver who comes from sort of their school of monofin diving, it's very important the head, shoulders, and neck position in a monofin streamline, because it can contribute to blackout if you're holding too much tension there, or if your sort of elbows, it's hard to describe over a podcast, but if your elbows are too twisted forwards, it creates a lot of tension and can disrupt blood flow. So there's a right and wrong, definitely.
Do you do recovery or hook breathing? I don't mean one or the other. I mean, it's basically just in case there's like maybe North American listeners that are not used to hearing recovery. Do you do some kind of special breathing after you dive?
Yeah, absolutely. I do it after every time my head comes out of the water, whether I'm snorkeling or whether I'm in a pool or, you know, or whether I'm actually on a target free dive. So I think it's really important. I've seen it. I mean, freedivers like to debate endlessly about how many breaths and how to do the breaths, but something is better than nothing. And I've seen it rescue people who have come up looking blue and purple, and they just look like absolute hell, and because they've got this recovery breathing drilled absolutely into their subconscious, they pull it back, you know, and it is definitely a worthwhile skill to focus on every dive, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, what is your experience with narcosis, and do you have methods or ways to deal with it?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because it's only just recently I'm starting to try and make friends with narcosis. I kind of never really had any experience of it. But once I started to consistently dive over 100, I can over 105, I can guarantee I'm going to have some sort of narcosis. The way down is normally fine. On the way up, I tend to sometimes just miss the ascent. I'm just on autopilot, and all of a sudden I'm turning at the bottom, making my way up, and I'm hearing a grouper call. I don't know where the last minute has gone. All of a sudden I'm up at 30 with the safeties. Also, on that last comp dive I did, the 112, I was told a few days later, I didn't remember this, but I was making faces and sticking my tongue out at the at the safety divers, which, you know, in a competition dive, 112, going for a national record, I shouldn't really be messing around like that. It's nice that I'm enjoying myself, but that was definitely the narcosis, you know. It was just making me be a bit silly. It's a bit embarrassing, actually, but yeah. So I'm slowly starting to think, okay, narcosis is a thing, but it's tricky to train for that. The advice I've been given is try and be a bit more lucid on the way up. Perhaps consider opening my eyes and focusing more on the rope. But in the past, I've kept my eyes shut because the last thing I want is to notice like the 80 meter mark pass and then think, oh, there's 75. Oh, there's 70. I don't really want that thought. But I definitely need to wake up a bit. Andrea Zicari sort of used the example of, you know, if you've had four or five beers and you're a bit tipsy, close your eyes, chances are you're going to fall over because you've just removed one of your senses, you know. So having your eyes shut and being blurry anyway underwater is like removing a sense, which can make you even more disorientated. So I don't really want to go down the route of fluid goggles. I don't think the ones I've tried don't seem that great. But next depth period, I'm going to be focusing more on being a bit more lucid and bringing in some anchors to my visualization, perhaps a dive time alarm or something like that, something to wake me up sort of when I'm sort of three quarters of the way up. Yeah, so it's a bit of an experiment. I'm talking to as many people as I can who've got more experience with it. It's a new thing for me. So it's something I'm having to learn.
Interesting. And then what about decompression-related symptoms? Have you had any kind of experience with that?
No, thank goodness, touch wood. You know, I've never had any issues with that. I know people who have. You know, a friend of mine, Stav, I think he gave himself a little bend when he first got hold of one of his scooters, one of those underwater scooters going up and down doing loop-the-loops. I know Andrea had a DCI episode from scooter diving. He did some pretty deep dives in close succession. But no, I haven't. It's funny because when I had COVID, when I got sick, we didn't know what it was. Someone suggested it might have been DCI. So, the first place I went was down to the decompression chamber and had a load of neurological tests and stuff like that with the doctor there who's really experienced. And yeah, he said within half an hour, it's definitely not decompression, but let's test you for COVID. It's rage these days. And yeah, that's when I found out I had COVID.
So they have a chamber there in Sharm?
Yeah, they do. And it's quite, the doctors there, people say he's probably one of the most experienced dive doctors in the world. Obviously focusing mostly on scuba, but since freediving has been in this area, he's been the go-to guy. And I'm really sorry, I can't remember the guy's name. Doctor something.
I imagine, yeah. I'll look him up and see if I can stick his stick his name in the show notes then, because I mean, even if you're in Dahab, that could be something that could come in handy further down the line. Often when you're in places like this, if you're in, you know, Egypt or Indonesia or Philippines, and something, you know, something escalates into an emergency, it can be quite disconcerting to not know where to turn. And you know, a lot of those places, they don't have the best infrastructure and facilities for these kinds of things. So it's always good to have a name out there.
Yeah, but that's why having something good like Dan Insurance is really good, because they've got a list of phone numbers you can call 24 hours to get some kind of hyperbaric advice. But the chamber here, although he's an incredibly experienced doctor, it's a wonderful balance of like a little bit high-tech medicine and a little bit DIY as well. It's kind of self-funded. It's not a government chamber. It's a private chamber. So it's like it's almost in like a porter cabin, but then at the back of it, they've got this gleaming new decompression unit, which is quite impressive. But then it's like a tatty kind of office full of hundreds of dive books. He's got all sorts of old memorabilia. It's an interesting place. It's worth just visiting if you're ever in town.
Well, that's cool. At least you have something to read when you're in the chamber then, right?
Yeah, but thank God I never had to have any treatment here. But having the chamber is something that I think divers don't really think about when they're looking at dive locations. I think most of us probably choose our dive locations by price firstly, and then how nice everything else is around it. But I know in Andrea's place in Sharm, they've had people from being out on the platform to being in the chamber getting treatment in 12 minutes. And I doubt there's anywhere that with such a good freediving setup, you know, with counter ballast, with scooter safety, and then being so close to a really good chamber. I don't think there's anywhere in the world that I know of that's like that. So Sharm, for all its, you know, it's not perfect, but for that, 12 minutes from being in the water to a chamber, that's remarkable. That's really good.
Yeah, cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Just apologies to those who are listening if the questions are a little bit in a weird order, because I haven't finalized the order here. What are you doing in your mind in the 2 minutes before your deep dives? Do you have a strategy mentally for that?
Yeah, I'm relying on my meditation practice, really. Like, if you never do any sort of mental practice, you can't expect your mind just to shut everything out and slip into the state you want it to just at the drop of a hat. So you know, the 2 minutes before my dive is actually a culmination of weeks of daily sort of Vipassana meditation. So I'm relying on that. I have had a habit in the past of drifting off a bit too much. I've missed, mostly in static, but I've missed official tops before because I'm just in a world of my own. I've just, you know, I've just heard 3, 2, 1 official top, and I haven't done any final breath or packing or anything. So I do need to, I try and open my eyes a bit more, but generally just enjoy the feeling of the water. So it's nothing massively specific. What I do is give myself 2 minutes. You know, I don't think anyone needs 15 minutes to breathe up on the line, you know, just don't do anything too extreme, but definitely dive on a countdown. Whether you're ever going to do a competition or not, that's irrelevant, but set yourself, I want 2 minutes. Someone's going to count that down for you. And at the end of that, I'm going. Otherwise, you know, when you're in that kind of halfway kind of mindset, you take your final breath and then you're like, oh no, I'll just do it again, breathe for another minute. And then you're taking 3 or 4 final breaths. And no, take yourself 2 minutes and just go when that 2 minutes is up.
Yeah. We don't want to be the guy that ends up causing everyone to wait, you know, 15 minutes before a dive starts either. Yeah, you know who you are, guys. You know who you are. Right. Okay. Do you drink coffee? And I'll just also ask the next one. Do you drink alcohol and do you smoke?
Today, not so much. I love coffee. Coffee's awesome. And to be honest, in the winter, when I was here, I tested it a little bit. I did some dives where I did absolutely zero preparation and just rocked up and sort of It sounds like I'm showing off. I'm not showing off. But, you know, I had a coffee in the morning. I didn't, you know, I just chilled out, read a book, went to the Blue Hole, and I didn't feel it made a huge difference. Obviously, I'm not having a coffee 20 minutes before I go in. I'm trying to leave a good hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. But no, I don't think coffee, people say I think it takes 24 hours or 48 hours to get out your system, but I don't notice an effect really when I dive. But then I stay away for sort of 2 hours before I get in the water. So yeah, I like coffee. Drink a little bit every now and again, not much. Yeah, alcohol is definitely one that is going to play havoc with your diving, I think, in my experience. And what was the third vice? The third smoking. Vice was smoking. Yeah. No, I don't smoke. But I do know people that do. I know some very deep divers that like a joint every morning and afternoon, you know, and it doesn't seem to have too much of an effect on them. I wonder what it would be like to do a deep dive while stoned.
Yeah, screw that.
I don't know if it's good or very bad. Probably very bad.
Yeah, I think it depends on your constitution and how, you know, your relationship with you know, things like that. But I know, yeah, it definitely wouldn't do me any good.
I read something years ago about the effect of a cigarette on a non-smoker. I can't remember any details about it, so it's purely a story. Like, someone who's not a smoker and they have one, it really opens up everything in their chest. It opens up the alveoli, they get flooded with blood because obviously the body sees it as poison, and it wants to give you the best chance to absorb oxygen. So it opens everything up. It has a real profound effect, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, a friend of mine years ago told me that there was, apparently, he was a bit older than me. I don't know if it's true or not, but he told me there was something that there used to be a bit of a fad called smogging, where people would go jogging and smoke at the same time, with the, you know, the theory being that, you know, you were kind of like activating your lungs or improving your respiratory, you know, capacity by smoking at the same time. He could have just been taking the piss out of me, but you never know.
Yeah, that might have been a wind up. I don't know. I mean, you look back in the 50s, they used to prescribe a cigarette for a sore throat, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, there, yeah, might be something in it.
Yeah, the best doctor is smoke camel. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the one piece of nutrition advice you would give?
I would say, if just eating whole foods, I think, is really important. Eating seasonally, if it doesn't look like it's just been picked off a tree or dug out the ground, then generally try and stay away from it. Anything that's been through as kind of a process. But yeah, you know, I'm not amazingly scientific with my diet. I just try and follow those sort of basic rules, really. Have a good variety of food. Bit of fish, bit of meat. I don't see it as a problem. But yeah, as long as you're getting good balance, staying away from baked goods and stuff like that. And if your food looks like it's just been picked, then I guess that's a safe bet. Those are the only kind of things I follow, really. And then last night I fried chicken, so it was a bit of a treat. Me and Harry gorged on it.
Sometimes you can have fried chicken. Yeah, it's a fact.
Yeah.
Do you take any supplements?
Certainly when I'm in a depth period, just the regular magnesium, iron, zinc, a bit of vitamin C. I take something called an enzyme called serrapeptase, which I didn't get the advice directly from Will and Dean Chalsh, but sort of secondhand, they were sort of taking it for a while. And it's, as far as I know, I'm not too up on the technicalities of it, but it's an enzyme that eats protein, basically. It's an anti-inflammatory and it eats proteins, but the type of proteins that are in scar tissues. And so we think it has a benefit for healing lungs and stuff. So if I'm in a depth period, I'll be taking that every day. Yeah. And you know, it's not like I took the pill one day and then everything was better the next day. But I think on paper, it certainly, it should be a benefit. So I take that. That's kind of the most unusual thing I take other than the regular. And then creatine, BCAAs, things like that. Just, you know, I'm 40 now, so I probably do need a bit more creatine in my diet, and then some protein, really. But then if I'm eating well and I've got access to good variety of food, I don't think protein's so essential to supplement. I think you can get enough of it if you're eating well.
What lifestyle or mindset change helped you improve more than anything else, if anything comes to mind?
I probably started to think to myself, what's so special about these guys that I look up to, guys, girls, whoever it is, the people that I look up to in the diving, like what's so unique about them? Will put, I think it was quite a few years ago, but he put a really nice article out about how he doesn't really believe in genetic advantages. I think the emphasis was that a lot of things can be trained. I mean, he is quite a gifted athlete, though. But I think the point stands that a lot of things can be trained if you approach it in the right way. And I just thought, yeah, you know what, I'm setting myself apart from all these elite divers that I want to aspire to. Why? You know, I've got two arms, I've got two legs. Why can't I do things at least close to what they do? So I think that sort of mindset really helped me sort of think, if they can do it, why can't I, you know?
Yeah, I think that's important that you have that mindset of evolution and development and progression and change to get to your highest aspirations, rather than having this kind of like locked in, solidified mindset where you've separated yourself from other people. Because I mean, it's amazing what we can achieve when we put our minds to it, and when we train and you know, mentally, physically, and you know, it's incredible.
Yeah, if you know, if we met 10 years ago and you told me I'd be diving, doing the stuff I'm doing at the moment, it was a world away. I just wouldn't have even contemplated it. I mean, it would have been a really nice daydream, but you know, I've never been high level in any other sport. I was sort of county level swimmer, not really anything that impressive, but I've just applied myself and thought, you know, yeah, if they can do it, why can't I?
Definitely.
So yeah,
you've done a good job, mate. Inspiration to all of us. Which person or persons have influenced your own approach to free diving the most?
Yeah, this is a tricky one because there's so many. You know, I think everyone I've ever met and taught and dived with has influenced me a tiny bit. I haven't made any of this stuff up on my own. You know, I'm a culmination of people I've met. But I think Mike Board, when I went over there and trained with him, he's the one that first taught me the kind of process of splitting up a dive, of just spending time just working on kicks to free fall, for example, and then working out ways to train on only the ascent, you know, dividing everything up. Before then, I was looking at a free dive as an entire process, start to finish, you know, how do I train free diving? Whereas he kind of had this sort of method of compartmentalizing a bit more and spending time working on the individual components. And I thought that was refreshing. And I've kept up with that. You know, I'll quite happily spend a week just diving down to 35 and turning around. You know, I think it's really valuable to spend time doing stuff like that. Also, like while I was over in Indo, I was really lucky to have Alexa and Natalia came over with a load of students. And one morning we went out on Mike's speedboat to the little shallow, well, not shallow, it's very deep, but the calm bay that we've got where we do the deep diving over there. And they came out, there was about five of us on the boat. And just watching her approach, you know what I said before about having this repeatable pattern that you can just slip into, and once it starts, it's a process like dominoes falling down, you know. Once it starts, it's exactly the same every time. And she had that kind of approach, calm, business-like, and also she was enjoying it. She was always smiling. She was never serious, you know, stressing herself out. And then afterwards, the dive, she did a massive dive. I think it was like 80 no-fins or something crazy. And then she went for a swim around the boat, just to swim off the lactic. And I was like, just blow my mind underwater, and now you're just swimming around like you've done nothing. So yeah, it's that kind of calmness that I thought, it was a really good example, I think, and I try and aspire to that.
Nice. two and three legends right there. Okay, what do you like to do on rest days, and do you have any strategies to speed up your recovery?
Ice baths, love them. Ice baths are amazing. We were doing ice baths in Sharm, but yeah, I definitely recommend ice baths. And then rest days, I mean, I like to rest, basically. Well, no, I don't like to rest. I like to be busy, but I have to make myself rest. And if I'm somewhere working on PB depth, then I really have to force myself to rest, because I'm a bit of, yeah, I just feel like I want to do something physical every day. But normally the diving does remind you that you need to chill a little bit. So yeah, I like to do as little as possible. I'm very lucky to have a girlfriend who is an amazing massage therapist. So she helps me out a lot. So yeah, massage, ice bath, and chill, really. And what I like to do, I don't like to spend my rest days, you know, people doing stretching sessions or lots of dry EQ training. I like to actually have a proper cutoff and not think about free diving. Mentally, that helps me a lot, because you're not switching off mentally if you're still planning and doing dry sessions and stuff like that. So yeah, I like to completely disconnect.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've figured that out myself over the last couple of years as well, you know, especially last year teaching free diving full time. You know, because I was teaching, I maybe wouldn't get as many workouts in or as many runs in or whatever that I had planned that I wanted to do. So when my day off comes along, and I'm just really like kind of forcing myself to go and do something. And I notice that my mental state is just really low. I'm just not in a good mood. And then I'm like, you know what, if I just lie here in the airco for the day watching, you know, movies, the next day I feel great. Yeah, I feel like I'm good to get back on it, and I'm good to go, and I've fully recovered. And that mental state is your body trying to send a signal through, you know, almost like in Morse code or something. Like, we need to stop for 24 hours and get our shit back together. But it can take a bit of time to learn that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, physically, we're capable of a hell of a lot. You know, we can really keep going until the point of exhaustion. For me, mentally, once I realize my focus is going, or if I find that my sleep is even slightly disturbed, I know that I'm just at the beginning of possibly overtraining. I've overtrained twice properly in my life. A lot of people say, oh, I'm a bit overtrained. But you know what? When you really go into overtraining, it's horrible. You're exhausted, but you just feel like you've had two double coffees, but you're exhausted. It's so weird. And you can't sleep, but you're exhausted and you're not thinking straight. It's not pleasant, proper overtraining. So it's important to definitely take some time. And sleep, man, sleep becomes so important.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, sleep is the number one, isn't it?
That's actually, when I had COVID, I was sleeping for sort of 10 hours, and then I was waking up and still having two maybe three naps throughout the day. So it was at one point, I think I was getting like 16, 18 hours sleep a day, and I just wasn't burning any energy, but my body was fighting, you know. And I knew I was coming out of it when I started to need less and less sleep. I was waking up earlier, you know, naturally. But yeah, it did, it made me sleep a lot.
All right, so describe your deepest dive in detail.
Yeah, well, my deepest dive was actually that last competition dive I did in Sharm. It should have been 112 meters constant weight, and it would have been the British national record. But obviously I had the beginnings of COVID, so it was a bit of a disaster. There must have been a bit of current on the way down. I actually got told by the safety that there was no current. I was the first in the day, and they went down and checked, and they said current's good. But then when I went down, I definitely got pulled out of position. And I remember one point, I felt... Normally I run the rope through a hand, and then sometimes it brushes against my shoulder. I try not to have too much contact for drag, but I felt the rope, somehow it was around the back of my neck and sort of weirdly around one of my legs. It was odd. I knew it wasn't right. So I'd fallen out of position, and it was only later I saw on what the judges saw on the camera that I'd sort of almost done a tumble turn down there. And in fact, I think it's the only time I've seen a red card for, they wrote UT turn. So I had to message them to ask what that meant. Underwater tumble turn. You know, this new rule that brought in after Nick's accident, where you're not allowed to turn head up and then right. continue down. So that's what the rule was for. So I've not seen that on any other comp result. So I think I might be one of the first weird records I have. Yeah. And then I missed the stopper because I was being pulled away from the line, out of position. I missed the tennis ball stopper, or the hard plastic stopper. It just slipped through my fingers. So obviously I sailed straight past the ball, straight past the bottom plate, and nearly headbutted the camera. The watch in my hood actually registered 113. So that was, a good meter difference with my head. So it wasn't, I'm putting it down to a bit of a mixture between current and then having the beginnings of having quite a serious illness. So yeah, my deepest dive ever was actually not my best dive by far. And then on the way up, I spent a good few seconds at the bottom because obviously I'd crashed past that bottom plate. On the way up was fairly good, but then I have that memory blank. I said the narcosis was really strong on that dive. And it was only about 3 days later when I was chatting to Roberto, the safety diver. And he said, yeah, I think you were knocked. And I'm like, oh, I'm not sure, And then he said, well, you were making faces at me and Tito and sort of sticking your tongue out. And I was like, ah, okay, definitely not behaving how I should have.
Right, yeah. And that proves that that question helps us know that the was your deepest dive also your best dive question is now redundant. We've answered that one. What is your favorite memory so far from your freediving journey?
Oh, yeah. There's loads. Getting to dive with someone like Natalia was pretty cool. With only four or five people out there, that was a really cool thing back then. Obviously, my first world championship was pretty amazing. I'd never represented the UK at anything. And then to go to somewhere like Nice, where the fanfare was wild. There was cameras and everything, and it was it felt really proper. That was pretty cool. I had a really nice trip to Santorini years ago. Diving wise, it was terrible because I got a cold and the wind was so bad that we lost so many days of diving. But it meant that all the divers there were kind of on holiday doing tourist stuff because we weren't diving. And that was the first time I met people like Julie Gauthier and Guillaume, and we were kind of just renting cars and seeing the island. That was a really cool holiday, even though I got almost no diving done. And I was there, I think I was doing my A-3 while I was there. And being an A-3 student and then hanging out with people like that, George and Dan were there as well, which was really fun. So things like that. I think those are my best memories.
And what's the best place you've ever freedived?
Mm.
Don't say Dominica. Everyone says Dominica.
Yeah, everyone does, don't they? I'm still going to shout out the quarry in Chepstow.
Oh, really? Yeah, where salt free divers is.
Yeah. Well, I think that's more because I've had some really nice weekends there, be it, camping, pub dinners, and then a bit of diving. It's an interesting place to dive, and it's where I started. So that's really cool. Ibiza's pretty special. The Caves of Light there. I think Dan, he did a video of his top five places in the world to dive, and Caves of Light was up there. He said it was the most beautiful place he's ever been. So that's a pretty impressive cave system there. So yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I just literally put out Louisa Collins' episode, and she said the same thing about the Cave of Light in Ibiza. Nice.
I listened to that this morning. Yeah, it's good podcast.
Cool. Okay, well, thanks, Gary. That's awesome, man. It's really fun talking to you, man. You like to answer these questions, obviously, and you have really helped me kind of get a nice structure here for them as well. Yeah, I'm kind of a little bit sad that you're not going to be, doing any competitions for a while, but I'm sure we're going to have you back on again at some point.
Let's see how it goes, because I have, I have an itch that I want to scratch. It's sensible head is telling me take the time, but if Johnny Sonic says, "Oh, I'm going to run a comp in November," that's going to be very tempting. So, never say never, but the plan is to definitely take some time to rest and just focus on teaching, focus on pushing the EQ online stuff, really.
Gary, I've had you for a good amount of time. Thank you so much. I need to get off and get something to eat and get some protein into my body. Let's say goodbye for the interview. Yeah, thank you. Thanks again for coming, Gary. It's like it's so much fun talking to you. Make the most of your rest and recovery time out there in Dahab and dive safe.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. It's been really fun chatting to you. I hope anything I've said is useful to people. excuse me. And if anyone wants clarification, just drop me a line. Happy to
All right.
help.
All right, cool. I'll make sure all the links to you and your platforms are there in the show notes. And yeah, until we talk again, Gary, take it easy. See you later, man.
Nice one. Thanks,
All right.
Dummy. See you,
Bye-bye.
mate.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Gary McGrath. Always a pleasure to talk to him. Let's all collectively wish him a speedy and safe return to serious depths after his brush with COVID. The next episode of the Freedive Cafe will be with Alice Modolo, who got herself a CMAS world record for the girls in constant weight bifins at Vertical Blue last month. Watch out for that coming pretty soon. If you're on Patreon, within a week, you will also get an early release of a training talk episode, another training talk episode with Hungarian champion Fatima Korok. Don't forget to like Free Dev Cafe on Facebook. Please leave a review there if you have time. On Apple, iTunes, whatever it's called. Nobody ever leaves a review. I mean, come on, guys. It takes like 30 seconds. Instagram, freedive and thrive, thrivespaceyoga.com, and thrivespaceyoga on Instagram for the yoga stuff. Talk to you soon, guys. Thanks for listening and dive safe.